Culinary Institute of Child Nutrition proudly welcomes you to The Mix-Up, an iBites production. I'm your host, Chef Patrick Garmong, mixing it up with culinary experts from the child nutrition community. Welcome back to The Mix-Up. I'm Chef Patrick Garmong. Today, I get to welcome Missy Poirier from the Palm Springs Unified School District. There, she's the Central Kitchen Supervisor. Missy, welcome so much to the Mix-Up podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to hear what you all are doing down there in Palm Springs to feed students during these abnormal times. And I had the great pleasure of working with you during the American Commodity Distribution Association presentation and was just really wowed by the things that you all were doing down there in Palm Springs and thought that it'd be really great to share that out with the nation. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we got a lot going on here. It's definitely not like any other school year. So
I bet a lot of people are agreeing with you right now. So yeah, go ahead.
We've just had to work out bumps and kinks, and you know, we're finally at a place where things are kind of going smoothly, and of course they're gonna throw a curveball at us anytime now.
That's right. You gotta be on your toes during these times. Yeah. So let's kind of start by just giving folks a little idea of your district demographics, kind of the size of your district, your free and reduced numbers pre-COVID, and what your average daily participation rate looked like back when things were quote unquote normal.
Right, pre-COVID. So we are a district of 27 schools, 16 elementary schools, and 11 secondary schools. Pre-COVID, we were about 23,000 students enrolled. Post-COVID or in COVID, we are right around 20,000. So we've lost quite a few. We served about 15,000 meals a day pre-COVID, breakfast, lunch, and supper, various programs at various sites. Now we serve 7-day meals on Wednesdays, every Wednesday curbside. And we do about 15,000, because we're doing about 5,000 students, 5,000 to 5,300 students, but they each get a 5-day breakfast, lunch, and supper at that time. So.
Wow, that's a big lift for your staff to package all that and do a single distribution. That's hats off to your team for making that happen for your community.
Yeah, we do it at 19 sites, and so it gives them a lot of locations where they can go and pick up meals. Right now, we're doing all frozen meals, so they can heat them up at home. The central kitchen actually prepares some products, and we package it up and give them cooking instructions. And it's kind of a kit, like a meal kit, that the parents can cook at home, or the students, if they're old enough to use that equipment, can cook at home. So there's recipes and reheating instructions right along with it.
Wow, it's almost like some of those online meal order programs that folks can have delivered to their house with all their ingredients and recipes for the week. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, very similar, kind of like a Blue Apron, except, you know, instead of raw chicken, we give them pre-cooked chicken that they just have to retherm. So, we don't do any raw product for the kids.
Yeah, keep the food safety.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I should let everyone know, too, Missy just ran in from one of her feeding sites or delivery sites to join us today. So thank you so much. I know you've had an extremely busy morning, and I am so thankful that you're able to join us. So tell us a little bit about what some of these pre-packed meal kits look like. What'd you guys serve this week?
This week we actually did what we call our country chicken bowl. It's kind of like a KFC bowl. It's mashed potatoes, corn, gravy, and a breaded chicken bite. So we packaged those things separately. So you'll get, the parents will get a package of chicken in one package, the corn in another, and the mashed potato and gravy is actually in a container that separates the two. So, and then all reheating instructions so that they know how to put it together. And then they get a photo of what it should look like on the plate. So what I vision it to look like on the plate, they get that picture so they can kind of see what I was thinking when I did it. So they can kind of duplicate it. So that's one that they got today. Last week we actually did a meatless bolognese sauce. It was with a plant-based meat. And we actually sent dry pasta home with that. So we made the sauce here in the central kitchen, portioned it out, sent them out with instructions on how to reheat that, and then we sent out dry pasta. It's just a better product for them to cook it at home rather than me cook it here and freeze it. Just ends up being a nicer, more fresh product when they cook it at home. So we sent them instructions on how to cook that pasta. You know, we do the same thing with rice. We do like a rice bowl like you'd get at Chipotle. So it's kind of a build your own bowl. We send rice and beans, and we send those dry with instructions on how to cook them. And then the rest of the ingredients that go in that bowl. So.
Wow.
Always a picture so that they can kind of envision what it's meant to look like on a plate.
Yeah, no, that's great. And it kind of speaks to, we briefly spoke about a little bit of your culinary background. It sounds like you've got a pretty good storied career in the food service industry. Would you like to share with some of the folks how you came into child nutrition and what you did prior to finding your way into the child nutrition kitchens?
Sure. Back in 1990, I graduated from culinary school in Massachusetts. That's where I'm from. And while I was in culinary school and while I was in high school, I worked at hotels and hospitals, actually, mostly, and a couple of restaurants. And then I was recruited down to Disney World. So I worked at Disney World for probably about 6 months. I really wasn't a fan of Florida. And I'm the youngest of 8 children. So being in Florida by myself with no family and no friends, really, I didn't know anybody at the time. It was hard on me to be away from my family. So I talked to my parents, and they were going to move to California because my oldest brother had moved to California. And so I left Disney World and moved out to California and started working for Sheraton Hotels. And I worked there for several years. And then I moved to Washington State, where I worked for McCormick & Schmick's. It's a Pacific Northwest fish house up there. And I worked there as the chef for quite a few years. And one day I decided to move to the desert. Don't ask me why. Just happened. Moved here on a whim. And I actually was working in restaurants here. And then my son, it was difficult with my son to get him to school and me working nights, because I would frequently work until 2 in the morning and be, you know, so it'd be really difficult with childcare and whatnot. So I decided to take a look at working for the school district. And it was actually one of the ladies in the office at the school he worked at told me, you should work for the district. I was like, well, let me look into it. And then now here I am 8 years later, I'm still here. And
yeah.
It's actually, you know, I say to myself, if my 20-year-old self knew this, that this was such a good job and that you could really make a great living doing this, I would have done it years ago. But then my 20-year-old self would never have done it, because my 20-year-old self wanted to be the great chef. And you just don't, I guess you don't correlate school food with great chef. So, especially when you're 20. So,
right.
I'm glad it's super fulfilling, and I really love this job. So.
Yeah. And, you know, we have a similar story where it was a varied level of restaurant and different I worked in universities and catering and restaurants for years and never saw myself in child nutrition, and had a similar situation where family and those needs need to be met. So I opted to apply for a district position and took that on and just absolutely fell in love with it. And it's really changed my perspective on food and how we're nourishing our children. And I would never go back, but you're right. My 20-year-old self wanted James Beard Awards and Michelin stars and all of that. And, you know, the reality is I've made a better living and have a better quality of life working in child nutrition than I ever did in the restaurant industry. So. Oh,
absolutely. I mean, there's absolutely no comparison.
Yeah.
Not at all. I would literally be retiring right now if I did this starting when I was 20.
You get to work human hours.
I would be 30 years in.
Yeah.
I'd be, peace out.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, It speaks to though on how you're taking care of your, you know, that background that you have in the hospitality industry speaks to how you're able to translate that into taking care of students, especially in these unprecedented times where you're thinking beyond just let's get food out the door, but let's facilitate a way to get them good, nutritious food, teach them some cooking techniques along the way, and give them an idea of what that food can actually look like and presenting it to them. And I think that's just amazing. And it really speaks volumes to why we need more culinarians in the child nutrition field. You know, I think we all have a place in it, and culinarians definitely belong here to help elevate the food. So we change that perception you and I had in our 20s of what school food is.
Exactly. And that's the thing is the kids now, they're going to force the change because the kids want food to be elevated. These students will not accept any mediocre product. They want the stuff that they think they can get at a restaurant. And if we try to feed them something that's subpar, they're going to call us out and they're not afraid to say, I'm not eating that. You know, they will tell you straight up, I will not eat that. We've got to come up with all kinds of ideas that we're seeing out there in the trends, you know, ramen bowls, pho, you know, these Chipotle style bowls. This is what the kids want. And we have to figure out how to make that happen under the regulations that we have to abide by. So, you know, it's very difficult. So that's why you do need culinarians here, because you need that creativity. You need that out of the box mentality. Because without it, I see a lot of school nutrition professionals that have been in this for years and they just can't think outside the box. They have a really hard time seeing, well, I can't make that In-N-Out burger for school nutrition. It won't be the same. You're right, it won't be the same, but we can make it pretty darn close. We can make that happen with what we have. You just have to think about it and think, you know, you really have to know about your nutritionals and work closely with your dietitian and, you know, your nutritionist in the site making your menu and make sure that you can hit those things that the kids really want. That's the only way we're going to get them coming through our line. Otherwise, they're going to Uber Eats their food to the back door of the school.
And that's, yeah, that's right.
A lot of, especially here in California, because they eat outside. So they just tell the Uber Eats guy to come to the gate.
And oh, wow.
They'll get their meal right there at the gate from the Uber Eats guy. So
yeah, we have to
very competitive.
Yeah, I think beyond the fact that it's a quote unquote captive audience, you know, you still have to appeal to them and meet them where they're at and meet their needs and still fall within all these regulations that we're you know, have the privilege of working under. So yeah.
Well, I think that's the thing that parents don't understand is the regulations. So that's,
yeah.
Whenever I have to meet with a PTG group or whatever, that's one of the things that I talk about is the regulations, so that they understand that we're not, you know, we're not trying to do things that we just created. You know, these are regulations that we have to abide by. You know, the trans fats, zero trans fat, the, you know, saturated fats have to be under 10%, and, you know, the sodium has to be at a certain level for each grade level. So
yeah.
The changes and the calorie count, you know, they all change as these kids grow and in their grade levels, all those minimums and maximums change with them. So we have to know all that stuff for each group of kids, elementary, secondary, you know. And I think that that's kind of something that they don't really think about. They're just like, why can't you just make food and put it out? Well, because that's not how it works.
Right.
But it's not. That's just, we have to make sure that those kids are getting a nutritious meal that's not going to be filled with fat and sodium, you know, that's going to be an issue. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you bring up a really good point, too, that getting out and talking to those parent groups is huge. I know that when I was a director, we had, you know, parents that thought that we were just either trying to do things on the cheap or not give their kids the types of foods that they wanted. And once we're able to go and talk to them and better explain our parameters, they became more of our allies than anything else and wanted to help us find those solutions and or at least get off our backs a little bit, so to speak, and have a little bit more appreciation for what it is that we do and for how we're feeding their children and trying to put some really healthy, flavorful, enticing food on their plate. I know one of the things that we talked about when we were gearing up for our ACTA presentation is your district's been doing a lot to meet the needs of children with disabilities and special diets. Can you tell me a little bit about what that looks like for your team, how you all are planning those menus, and then also how are you communicating with families to find out who's going to be at the pickup site with those special dietary needs? I'm sure you've got quite the story.
Yeah. Well, you know, we started basically with pre-COVID. So pre-COVID, whoever we were doing about 108 allergy meals a day pre-COVID. So we looked at those pre-COVID kids and we emailed and called every family to find out if they were going to be in fact picking up, so that we could still accommodate those needs for them. And those families that said, no, we're not going to participate, we just took them off our list for now and let them know that anytime they're deciding to participate again, let us know. So that's kind of how we reached out to them. Pre-COVID, we have the medical accommodation form that they fill out when they're enrolled or when they have a new doctor's note. So they fill that form out, give it to us, we verify everything, we create a menu for that child. Allergies are crazy. It's not, there is no one size fits all.
Yeah, that's right.
Allergies. You have some kids that can't have dairy. You have some kids who can't have peanuts. And then you have kids that can't have dairy, peanuts, corn, seafood, you know, garlic, onions. There's, the list can go on and on and on. I mean, there's kids that I look at their allergy list and I'm like, oh, goodness gracious, what am I going to feed this child? You know, you really, again, have to think, what can I get? We also have these procurement, you know, rules that we also have to follow. So we don't have anything in our bid that maybe meets that. So you have to go outside your bid and do a micro purchase. And there's just, it's a lot of bureaucratic stuff that happens there, but you make it happen. You know, you find out that, you know, I have to have this certain thing for these children, and that's what I'm going to go out and I'm going to procure it. You know, and you figure out how to do it. And sometimes it takes a little time to get there. But once you're there, it becomes smooth sailing. And so we have a list every week of who those kids are. If they don't show up, we contact the parents and say, hey, you didn't show up, you know, this week, you're going to come next week. And we give them, you know, we just let them know. And if they've decided, you know, I'm not going to, they just let us know. And it's fine. So right now we're making, I think, like 46 meals for kids that are actually picking up, and we put together 5 days, and it can become very repetitive. It's unfortunate, but it does. Some of them are very, very limited. And so it is a very repetitive menu. So they'll get maybe 3 days of one thing and 4 days of another, because it is super, super restrictive what their diet is.
Right. I was just going to ask, is it based off of the number of allergies that they have that kind of limit the different options that you have available for this medium of service?
Yeah, we do the best we can to serve them as close to the menu that everybody else is getting, you know, as possible. Sometimes it's just, there's just no way we can get there. But we try and make something similar, you know. So if we're serving a taconada, which is kind of like a cross between a taco and an empanada, We will make something as close to that as we can that still fits that particular child's allergy, you know, list. And literally the list that I have for allergies, it's the student, what their allergies are, and here's your week's menu. And as much as we can duplicate that menu, we try to, if it fits with other children's allergies. Sometimes there's, you know, the one kid that gets something completely different than everybody else, because it's the only way we could do it.
Yeah. So are you putting together those special diet meal kits at one site, or are they going out to different sites? What are your control mechanisms on that, especially worrying about, you know, you're preparing so many meals at once? You know, I know everyone's probably going, oh, cross-contamination. How are you preventing that? Or cross-contact really is more the issue with special diets. You know, how are you putting those controls into place, and how can others learn from what you're doing?
We actually do all of those here in the central kitchen. So we are blessed because we have a central facility. And in my central kitchen, I have a kind of an area that's all allergy meals. And so the allergy meals are listed as from the most restrictive to the least restrictive. And so that's how we make them. So we make the most restrictive first. Get all of those done, clean and sanitize the entire area, and then start with the next group. So we do try and group them so it makes it go a little bit quicker. Because if you tried to do them one by one, it would take all day long.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's really smart. I'd imagine it probably took a handful of hours to even just kind of configure what's the most restrictive and least restrictive on some of these, as well as different, you know, different allergens, just creates, you know, different layers of cross contact issues. So
it has been a hit and miss process for sure.
Yeah.
You know, we've perfected over the past 5 years. You know, 5 years ago, we didn't have near as many allergy meals first, but you know, as it's gotten bigger and bigger, we've had to perfect the process because it took more and more time. You know, so you have one person spending an entire 8 hours doing this. It's not really productive. It's not the most effective use of time for that person. So we've got it down now where it only takes about an hour and a half for the 40.
Oh, wow.
And pre-COVID, we were doing over 100, it was taking about 2.5 to 3 hours. And then we deliver it directly to the site. So as soon as they're finished, I have people get into vehicles and send them out to the sites.
Wow.
So the site has it, it's labeled who it goes to, everything they're supposed to get is in the box. And so when the parent drives up and they say, I have an allergy student, that site picks up that box and there you go, you're ready to go.
Wow, that's awesome.
There is no cross contact outside of the central kitchen because it's all boxed.
Right. No, that's really smart. It sounds like you got your team's using a lot of different types of disposable wares to send all this packaging out. Have you had any difficulties with procuring any packaging? Or I know I've heard throughout the nation that they've had some struggles with that. So how have you been able to overcome that? Or is it kind of a weekly crapshoot, so to speak?
Well, we source stuff out from everybody, so we've had to do a lot of quoting because these are things that are not necessarily on our bid for procurement. So we've done a lot of requests for quotes to be able to get the stuff in house, and we buy it by the pallet. We don't mess around. If I have a t-shirt bag and I need it to be clear, I am going to buy a month's worth, not going to just buy 1 week's worth, because next month it might be harder to get that bag. And we found that we were buying this clear bag that we could so you could see what you were getting in the bag, and now that clear bag we can't get, so now we're going to an opaque bag. We can see through it, but you know, we're looking at every vendor and we're saying, okay, what can you give me that's similar, you know? And if they can't provide something, who's the next vendor that we could have gotten it from?
Right.
That's really, it's not easy. It's not easy. We're actually doing a turkey dinner for Thanksgiving. So we're giving out the whole turkey.
Oh, wow.
Fresh potatoes, corn, bread so they can make stuffing, and we'll put recipes together. It'll go with it. So we're actually going to do that on a different day than our serving day. So we serve on Wednesdays. And so the week before Thanksgiving, the Friday before, we're going to do a turkey giveaway. And so procuring turkeys was a challenge.
Yeah. I can imagine.
But we need 3,000 of them. So it's a challenge, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we utilize our commodity dollars with DOD, you know, for the vegetables and whatnot, onions and carrots and, you know, and potatoes and whatnot. That's not as hard. But the turkeys were, that was a challenge.
I can only imagine.
But you know, we do it for the families, we do it for the community, we do it for the kids, and we want to make sure that they're missing so much not being in school. We want to make sure that they're getting something, that they're getting something that's as normal as possible for them. You know, so
that's amazing.
Yeah, we gave out pumpkins today.
Oh, that's cool. I like that. Yeah.
The Dodgers won the World Series last night, so I was a Dodger dog today.
Oh.
I'm not even a Dodger fan or a Red Sox fan, but I was like, that's okay, I can do this.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, I love the way you guys are engaging the students and trying to find some normalcy in the most abnormal circumstances in their lives. So your district currently is 100% remote, or do you have any students in school?
We are 100% distance learning at this time.
Okay.
But in 2 weeks, we are going to be getting small cohorts coming back. And those are going to be the students that are really not thriving in a distance learning situation. So we will have probably about 600 kids on campus at various sites to take care of that. But our county, we still can't have the kids back in. So we're on a special waiver putting these cohorts together from the state. We got a waiver from the state so we can bring back, you can't have more than 40 something kids, less than 50 for sure, on campus, on any campus at any time right now. And then we're hoping to get to a hybrid situation in January after our winter break.
Okay.
But it's going to really depend on the county and where the county sits with COVID cases. And we're on a tier system, and right now we're on the worst tier. So hopefully we can upgrade to get to a better tier so that by January we can get kids at least 50% back into school.
Yeah. Well, that's that curveball you were talking about when we started, right? Here it comes down the pike. And
so now we're going to have to be making meals for the few students that are on campus.
Right.
Continuing doing the curbside on Wednesday. So it's 600 kids, but it's 20, we're actually only going to do 25 sites. It's 25 sites and coordinating getting that food to the site prepared and bagged up and ready for the kids is a curveball, but it's okay. We can, we pivot. We've learned really well how to pivot, and we're going right. And then they tell us you got to go left. Boom. We're going and we're going to figure it out.
That's right.
That's what we do. I mean, nutrition service and food service people in general, we thrive in chaos. We really do. I mean, you think about your restaurant days,
yeah.
In chaos. So that's our wheelhouse. We got this.
That's exactly what drew me to the restaurant industry. I think I read Anthony Bourdain's No Reservation, or which book was that? Kitchen Confidential. And all of a sudden I was on a plane to New York to go to culinary school. It was apparently I wanted to be with a band of pirates. So now I'm with a much better band of more like the VeggieTale Pirates as we're out there nourishing our students. Missy, it has been so great to talk to you today. And I just cannot thank you and your team enough for everything you're doing for the children in your community. You all are going above and beyond, and just my hat's off to you all. Thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. I enjoy talking to you. So anytime.
Yeah, we'll have to catch up again soon. Hopefully we can grab a meal when we get to a conference face-to-face again down the road.
Nice. How about you miss having a meal? I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do, for sure.
Join us next time as we continue to mix it up with culinary experts from the child nutrition community. I've been your host, Chef Patrick Garmong from the Culinary Institute of Child Nutrition. Hey, don't forget to wash your hands.
This project has been funded at least in part with federal funds from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Food and Nutrition Service through an agreement with the Institute of Child Nutrition at the University of Mississippi. The contents of this publication do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, nor does mention of trade names, commercial products, or organizations imply endorsement by the U.S. government. The University of Mississippi is an EEOAA Title VI, Title IX, Section 504, ADA, ADEA employer. In accordance with federal law and U.S. Department of Agriculture policy, this institution is prohibited from discriminating on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, age, or disability. To file a complaint of discrimination, write USDA Director, Office of Civil Rights, Room 326W, Whitten Building, 1400 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 202-509-410, or call 202-720-5964. USDA is an equal opportunity provider and employer.